This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 529 in the series. This session shares the Franklin Mass Budget Finance Committee budget hearing held on Wednesday, April 28, 2021. The meeting was conducted in a hybrid format. Members of the Finance Committee, selected guests, and town administration personnel were in the council chambers. The remainder were remote along with the public via the Zoom conference bridge, all to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. The show notes contain links to the meeting agenda, including documents released for this meeting. So let's listen to the budget hearing on public safety.
Announcements to make. The first is a COVID statement. Due to the continued concerns regarding the COVID-19 virus and Governor Baker's declared state of emergency, we will be conducting a remote virtual finance committee meeting for all public access and participation. In an effort to ensure citizen engagement and comply with open meeting law regulations, citizens will be able to dial into the meeting using the provided phone number, cell phone or landline required, or citizens can participate by clicking on the attached link, phone, computer, or tablet required. The attached link and phone number will be active for the duration of the meeting for citizens to ask questions and voice concerns. The residents are just interested in watching the meeting. It will also be live streamed by Franklin TV and shown on Comcast Channel 11 and Verizon Channel 29. And with that, I'll ask if there are any public comments. I don't see any. So now we'll move on to the continuation of our budget hearings. I just want to remind everyone, both members and as well as attendees, that the vote on the budget book will come at the end of our deliberations sometime next week. So Jamie, you want to take it away?
Sure. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through you to the Finance Committee and the folks watching at home. I'm going to just give a quick reference to the folks who may be watching on TV. Please, if you got your tablet or laptop in front of you, go to franklinma.gov, the town website, go to town budget, FY22 budget materials. You can also go to our social media pages where all of this is posted as well. I'm going to start off tonight with obviously accounts 210 police department and through the rest of the public safety departments. By reference to the Finance Committee, I am in Appendix A1, the Town Administrator Recommended Budget Voting Document and Budget Book, which is required by the Town Charter, and I am on page 53 of 127. One more. So overall, if you get onto page, 54, you'll see down at the total expenses for the department and the personnel. This year it is about $230,000 increase for the Franklin Police Department. And, most of this is pretty straightforward. The police chief is here tonight and he'll explain how he was able to cobble together a new officer position in this budget. There will be a plus one through some creative techniques and some other one-time staffing moves that we didn't anticipate this year. The bulk of the increase, if not all of it, pretty much is due to contractual agreements. As we mentioned last night, the 2% COLA. And in addition, for the chief this year, there are a series of retirements that we're planning for. And so those costs for any of the contractual obligations, either from the CBA or the employment manual for non-union, those retirements are compensated in this budget as well. The chief may even get in tonight. Him and the staff have been working a lot on succession planning due to what's likely to be a bunch of retirements over the next year or two. In addition, as I mentioned last night, this budget also accommodates both for police and fire for tonight's purposes. And FY22 accommodates for the increased cost due to the new state holiday, Juneteenth, which the town of Franklin is obviously going to honor. And finally, before I turn it over to the chief, if there's any questions from the committee, he wants to explain again, the good news is the department was able to find another way to fit in one more police officer with no budget impact. So, you know, maybe if you could give the police chief a few minutes to explain his magical wand and how he did that.
Absolutely.
Any other points he may want to say, and then we'll take questions from the committee. Chief?
Wave the wand, you'll agree to everything.
Good evening. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks. So, yeah, as Jamie stated, we've been trying to increase the numbers. You know, the goal to our five-year vision plan is to get up to what the average is for most of the communities that are a similar size in Massachusetts, which would be about 57. Obviously, we don't have the funds to do that all at once. So we had an interesting thing occur where we had one of our senior officers ended up finding additional, you know, new employment, and he's now a clerk magistrate over at the Rentham District Court. So him leaving at a, you know, top step patrolman, you know, master's degree, and we replaced that with a, you know, first step associate's degree individual, offered one opportunity, and then our firearms instructor, head firearms instructor, Sergeant Robert McCory, had come up with an idea on his own on a way to save money for the training that we do. And part of it was going from a particular range that we go to now through the town of Bellingham to the Hockington Gun Club in Hockington, Mass. And we were able to save some money on the cost of actually going to the range, but the biggest expense or savings of money came from the fact that we don't have to use frangible ammunition in Hockington like we do in Bellingham. They allow us to use regular lead-based ammo. And the frangible ammunition is twice as much. And so we were able to do some reductions and change some of the training we're able to do so we can actually pick up, you know, ammo for the 40 millimeter, less lethal rounds and things like that. But we were able to cobble that together along with some other staffing moves and everything else to be able to, technically we added $1,000 to the budget from what we originally came up with.
It was 930 actually, I think. It was even under 1,000.
To be able to hire another officer. So it worked out good. Now, as far as those things go, not just because I'm wearing short sleeves, I have no more rabbits up my sleeves or anything like that to be able to cobble any additional officers within the existing budget. That is over. The 4-4 schedule plan allowed us to hire 5. We got this one. We had a deal with Tri-County to be able to, they pay half and we pay half of an SRO. I'm done. There's just no more places to go. Any increases, unfortunately, everybody will tell you right now, we're going to have to be an increase in the budget to be able to get us to that 57 at some point.
And what are you at now?
53.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? I have a few questions for you, partly a follow-up to our March meeting on the deep dive.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
So I'll go first, I guess. And you mentioned succession plan, or Jamie did. And I had two questions, actually. One was, how many sectors is the town divided into the police department? You divide the town into patrol sectors, correct?
4.
4?
There are 4, sir.
And so obviously there's 4, you always have at least 4 patrol cars on the street most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, get into specifics, but, you know, as far as how many. But, yeah, I mean, with the overlaps and stuff like that, there's usually more than 4
okay.
officers on the road, with the exception of the overnight. For a period of the overnight shift. But yeah, there's always, you know, that, you know, 4, there are 4 sectors, there are 4 offices. Day shift obviously has additional personnel due to the fact that the SROs are around and in the schools, right. All the detectives are working and so forth.
And this might tie into the succession issue is, and I know the fire department addressed this recently with span of control issues. And I remember back at the last meeting, you said there's like a, you divided your operations division into 2 essentially, and you have 3 shifts. But yeah, you have 1 lieutenant and 3 sergeants each. Is that how that works?
No, there's 1 lieutenant that runs the division.
Right.
And the operations, there are 6 sergeants.
Right.
And now 30 patrolmen. And so there are 3 sergeants and 15 patrolmen in one squad, 3 sergeants and 15 patrolmen in the other. So when the 3 and 15 are working, they have a mirror that is off on the 4 on and 4 off. So that's how it works.
But
so span of control is, we're still within the 1 and 7, which
okay.
by ICS standards would be, you know, the max.
And that was my question, if you have adequate supervisory and span of control.
We're there, but we're getting to the maximum.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting to that point where eventually we might need, you know, more supervisor, you know, on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for the 4 additional that would allow me to put, you know, another officer in a mirror on a 6 to 4 shift and another officer in a mirror on the 11 to 9 p.m. shift, which would then allow for two over the minimum of what we need right now,
right,
at the minimum that we feel is for safety and for call for service volume, which would then allow us to make sure that we're always going to be okay as far as, you know, overtime goes. For I've never, in the 4.5 years that I've been the chief of police, I've not been at full staff, not once. I think for 2 weeks, that's it. Between extended injuries and illnesses, vacancies that take a while for us to find a qualified individual to put in there. So we're always behind. And you've probably seen, I mean, our unscheduled overtime, I'm sure Chris watches it all the time and gets nervous. We always seem to, you know, come in at the end and so forth, but the non-scheduled overtime is a lot. This was one of the reasons I went to, yeah, to fill this hole. These two offices we're getting now, because
right,
I moved somebody from detectives. I had to do it. I didn't want to, but we had to do it. And then pick up the 53rd is allowing us to put one officer on each squad on the 1 a.m. to 11 a.m. that will now put us at least one over the minimum 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's what I would do with those. But then we are going to get into those. You know, the next things would be, you know, span of control and additional supervisory staff. My admin staff is, you know, working hard and thin. I mean, there's myself, the deputy, and three lieutenants. And, you know, we're basically doing all the administrative work and everything like that.
So a sergeant runs the shift, basically.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
I'm just curious. If you look at the anniversary dates, there's a lot of retirements coming, I would assume.
There is a lot of retirements, yes, sir.
And there's one going, Jimmy Lawrence goes back to 87. So I assume that by definition will free up salary. So at some point.
I expect six within the next 2 years, or by, you know, the July, right after July of 2023, not this fiscal year, but the following fiscal year. You know, two possibly this year, and at least another four right after the fiscal year starts in 2023.
Oh. Well, a double-edged sword. It also gives an opportunity to regular patrol officers to move up.
Everybody loves people that retire with rank.
Yeah. Well, that's where most of the old people are.
More senior people.
Yeah. I understand. Don't call Jimmy our oldest patrolman. He's the senior patrolman.
He's officer one, if I remember.
Yeah, he is. Always the senior patrolman is officer one. So, I mean, he has his own badge number. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. It's low anyway, because when we went to the badges. But the senior patrolman always wears badge number one.
I'm good. Thanks.
Any other questions for Chief Lynch?
I have a question.
Mike?
So just based on what George just mentioned, when somebody retires, does that burden shift now from an active police department salary to now the pension that we talked about last night? Maybe that's a question more for Jamie. Is that just a shift of funds or responsibility?
I mean, in terms of pension or healthcare?
I guess both.
Both. So if I follow the question correctly, essentially they become a retired, you know, first of all, from a pension standpoint, they apply to the Norfolk County Pension Board and they go through the process to go ahead and get their pension. And, you know, Karen does a great job trying to anticipate and having a heads up of when that happens. In the last collective bargaining agreements, one other thing we prioritized was an incentive to have knowledge as early as possible. And Chief, correct me, I can't remember, is it 6 months? Is that the?
Nine is the max.
So we try to get someone to get a top tier buyout of their vacation or leftover time 9 months early, so the chief has a pretty good, you know, forewarning of when that person's going to retire. They put it in writing, and so that's helped us a little bit in recent years, and I think it's going to help moving forward anticipate when people are going to retire, so we have plenty of time, so we don't have what the chief just mentioned, which is large gaps of time in between when somebody retires and when we can fill that slot. Or even if they were an academy candidate, you know, that only extends it that much more in addition to the field training. Secondly, in terms of health insurance, were you referencing OPEB, Mike?
Yes.
The OPEB. So that's a better, to be honest with you, I don't think we've even ever done a deduction from OPEB. OPEB is really like a long-term savings account. And so the insurance goes from active health insurance to retiree health insurance. So it's kind of just two accounts within the town's budget that we pay the health insurance premiums. The OPEB trust fund is there as kind of a long-term savings account, knowing that health insurance costs are going through the roof but yet there was a systematic issue with contribution rates at one point in time. As we mentioned last night, many years, the splits were, in the old days, they were probably 95-5, so the town would pick up 95% of the bill. The state government, Commonwealth, was like that up until the 2000s, whereas it was a 90-10 split, an 85-15 split. And so we know that we can't afford that within the operating budget. And that's what the actuarial is done for every 2 years, to show what's your financial liability for what we call other post-employment benefits, which largely is a fancy term for healthcare, for long-term savings account for health insurance. So we have not tapped into that fund yet to pay any of that liability, because we have enough resources to be able to pay for that now. But the dynamic that we're seeing at the police department in the next couple of years is a trend we're going to see throughout all of town government. And we've already seen it now since I've been here in 6 years, where eventually that liability may be so expensive that the town's budget may not be able to pay for it. And so we have that as a backup, as a safety net, if you will. I hope that answered your questions, Mike.
You all set, Mike?
I have more, but go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So the other question, totally kind of just unrelated to what you talked about. I'm looking at the narrative here, and you mentioned the co-response jail diversion program. I guess this program clinician, is that somebody who's on payroll of the town, or who employs that person? And then second part to that question is, you have cost savings to the criminal justice system as well as the emergency department. Is that a town savings that the town sees, or is that like, why are we accounting for savings somebody else might see? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, so through you, Mr. Chairman, so sure. The jail diversion program is it's basically a grant from the Department of Mental Health that the state has. So we get the grant between us and Medway. It's a regional jail diversion program. So Callie Montagano, who's the clinician, she works 40 hours a week. She spends 3 days at our station, 2 days at Medway. She can cross border at any time. She goes out with the officers and she responds to mental health related or substance abuse related calls for service. The $90,000 grant is what pays for her salary and the overhead at Advocates, which is the emergency service provider that received the grant. So we get the money and we just sign the check over to Advocates. She is not an employee of the town. There are no benefits paid to her. All of her benefits and her salary come directly from Advocates, and she technically works for them, but she works under us and provides that service to us. Those numbers come from Advocates. You know, the jail diversion program is Framingham, Hawkington, Ashland, and one other community are all part, you know, they have one. There's several communities that have these regional programs, and that's what they're basically saying, is that the cost to the medical, you know, and so forth, for having to bring somebody there on a Section 12, she's able to actually work with people at the house and so forth and make a determination, does this person really need to go to the hospital on a Section 12 hold? You know, no, they don't. You know, we can probably get them, you know, outpatient care or something like that, and then continues to work with them, you know, on that. So it's a cost savings to them. It saves us from having to bring the person to the hospital, you know, and then hand them off to the hospital security and so forth, and then come back, you know, write the reports and all that, versus, you know, she just works with them. So it does save us the time and money and, you know, and effort in that. And really, she's providing a better service than we could provide, and technically what I believe the emergency department can provide down at the hospital.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Okay.
Susan?
I have two questions, Chief, if I may. The first one is, you mentioned in here, and you said it, there are 10 communities that you compared or used as comparable communities, and their average staffing is 57.6. We're putting through a budget at 53. May I ask, you don't have to spit them out now, but maybe as follow-up to this meeting, a list of those communities and their level of staffing?
Yeah, I mean, some, like off the top of my head, I think Braintree is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the high 80s. You know, they're basically border Boston and so forth. It's tough to find, to tell you the truth, it's actually tough to find communities to compare us to if you're going to use population. You know, we're around 35,000. Most of the communities in Massachusetts are 25,000 or less. Mm-hmm. I can't think off the top of my head what they are. I have the whole thing. I mean, we did the survey a while back. It's actually a couple of years old. But that was the average somewhere, you know, like I said, in the 80s and the 70s. And the FBI basically says 1.9 per 1,000. I'm not saying we need 70 something, you know, right now in Franklin, but at 53, we're light, we're short. You know, we need more you know, people, the call for service volume's going up, the population isn't going down. You know, some of the, you know, the bigger projects that we have, like the Westerly and so forth that have gone in, you know, they're just adding to the call volume. We're over there all the time.
Oh, I have no doubt. But I think it would be good as backup. And I don't know if anybody else on the committee would find that interesting, but I know we haven't looked at that for a long time, you know, kind of comparable towns. So if as a follow-up, if you could just send that.
I'll get that to Chrissy, if that's good.
And, yeah, and that would be great.
Forward it to you. I'll do it tomorrow. No problem.
And my second comment is, yet again, you come without Ben Franklin. Why? Why? Where's Ben?
Ben works in the day. You know, Ben's a day shift.
We do too.
Officer with Jamie, you know, his handler, Officer Maccheroni, Jamie Maccheroni. Well, if I did that, then I think, you know, you'd think I'm basically bringing Brendan, you know, to get over on you and so forth. I don't know if that's appropriate either.
I think he's a wonderful spokesman, so maybe next time.
All right, well, next time. If you promise not to ask any questions and just prove everything, Ben will be here, I swear.
All right, so I'm all set. Thank you.
Nicole?
Just a quick question. The education incentive on the personnel sheet, is that just anticipated training costs for the police officers, or is that actually like incentivizing them to go out and do something independently that they then get paid out for, or is
no? That's part of their salary. It's them for attaining degrees. Back in 2012, before 2012, 09 is when the state basically said they weren't going to pay the PCIPP program, which is the Police Career Incentive Pay Program, otherwise known as the Quinn Bill. The state wasn't going to pay their share anymore for 3 years. It took the basically the Mass Supreme Judicial Court to make a determination that contracts that had certain language that the town didn't have to cover it. Town of Franklin made a choice to have educated police officers and to continue that payment. There was, you know, the unions ended up working out, you know, something. So that's they technically get, it's very similar. It's about 10% for an associate's, 20% for a bachelor's, and 25% for a master's. Now, not every department in Massachusetts did that. A lot of them ended up, you know, basically saying, we're not going to give you the other 50%. So they grandfathered in current employees at the time. Mm-hmm. And so from a retention, from a recruitment standpoint, I made a big push with the town, and I'm glad that they did it, that we're going to end up having a tough time being able to get people at a time when we're short and need to be able to get people very quickly. It's definitely one of the reasons I've been able to hire a lot of transfers, you know, which goes to what Jamie said when it comes to the succession and people leaving. It's a year from the time we end up using the list, finding an academy that's open, and they pass everything to get in it. It's 6 months in the academy, and it's 3 months of a field training. So that's 3, 6, 3. That's a full year. That whole time, there's an open slot where an officer should be in the cruiser out on the road performing the job. Without that, I would definitely not have been able to hire people as quickly, and I would probably have had people left. And I have not had many officers leave to go to another police department. Matter of fact, I've only had one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And really quickly.
Yes, Jamie.
Could you just, Chief, could you just elaborate a little bit more on what we have done in the last several years on the education incentive? Because I know this was a big deal. And I think to Nicole's question, but other folks, they may want to hear that commitment from the town, you know, and the members about what we did, you know, over the last few years as a part of the 4x4. Just the parity in the educational incentive was a huge deal, because I do think education and training, I don't think anybody's going to deny this, is critical to a great police force. And I think it shows here in Franklin. It also shows that's why the numbers are high in that column. But that's something we shouldn't shy away from. And, you know, TJ's point earlier, and I think it's just worth explaining quickly, the Quinn Bill had its history 20 years ago, and there was a lot of inconsistency at the local level on this. And I think the work that the chief has done, in addition to the rest of the staff, on bringing that parity is really, really important and really sets us up for success in the next several years. So could you just talk about that real quick, Chief?
Sure. I mean, they didn't what are you talking about, the new employees not being a parent?
Yeah.
So there was almost a dual system. There was a dual system going on as far as the contractual agreement. So anybody hired before 2012 had a certain benefit level and so forth, yet those after 2012, it was different. So they didn't really do parity. They didn't, at the beginning, and for several years, the newer employees after 2012 did not get the 10, 20, 25%. It was a set amount, and it was much less. And of course, I again did a survey and talked, you know, with other non-civil service departments, because at the time we had become non-civil service, and you could find departments like Norwood and Walpole and others that kept the full 10, 20, 25 for all employees, and those officers were getting $9,000-$10,000 more for the same work. And then, of course, for our own employees, you know, once you've been on 3-4 years, you know, five technically, I mean, you're at that level where you've probably seen everything, and you're as experienced as somebody that has 10 years on the job. Not totally, but you know, mm-hmm. but now you're working together, the same shifts and this and that, and this officer is making $10,000 more than that officer for the same degree level and so forth. So we kind of, you know, the town agreed. I was glad with it, but I fought for the fact that I think that they should receive, you know, parity for those same reasons, again, for retention, morale, you know, for hiring purposes and so forth. So I'm just glad that they did it, and I think it's you know, I know the employees are good with it, and like I said, I don't have people looking to move to another job yet. I'm able to pull people from other jobs, other agencies, to come here. And I think it's a combination of that. We pay well, we have good equipment, and you know, the community supports us, and you know, we're progressive and do a good job.
One more, Judge.
Are we still, in light of all of the events over the last months, are we still non-cameras at all? And I understand the cost, but you know, the way it's going, they've proved to be beneficial in a lot of cases.
Are you talking the body cameras?
Yeah.
Yeah. Through you, Mr. Chairman. So the, and I talked about this at the subcommittee for capital. With the council, I think it was Council Pellegrini had asked the same question. And so I'm not adverse to body cameras at all. Matter of fact, I believe the body cameras would probably end up maybe, you know, more often assisting in, you know, complaints that might have came on the officers or something like that, because our my officers do a fantastic job. But it's the cost. There's a cost to it, and then you got to look at the cost benefit to it. So complaints. Are we receiving complaints from the public about our offices, whether it be anything from rudeness to excessive force? Except no, we're not. I'm telling you right now, it's just that nobody's coming in to complain. And the body cameras are kind of like a printer that you would buy for your house. You can go buy a printer, real nice one too, for probably cheap money. They'll give it to you because they're going to charge you for the ink. Go to buy ink, you're spending hundreds of dollars on ink or thousands a year. They'll give you the body cameras. On the cost of the body cameras themselves isn't very expensive. It's the storage that you have to do in the cloud or otherwise, and how much you have to store is a recurring, very expensive expense. Number one. Number two, due to the public record laws in the state of Massachusetts, anybody can ask for that footage, and all we can and so I'm going to have to pay somebody to hire another person to specifically just go through all that footage to redact anything that by law can be redacted, such as if it's a domestic violence case, you can't do anything that would indicate who the person is or anything like that, but I would still have to give that. And I'm not talking just court. I'm just talking a citizen that decides, I don't want to watch Cops on Channel 5 or 7. I want to watch the Franklin PD, and I want all the footage for the last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and we have to give it to them. And so it becomes very expensive. I've seen a number of departments similar size to us that went with body camera programs, not necessarily in Massachusetts, but in other states. And then after a while, it gets so cost prohibitive that they're cutting employees to potentially have to pay for it. And so they decide to abandon the program. So that's part of it. I'm looking for more bodies, not body cameras. I need the bodies to put the cameras on eventually if we can afford it. But I need the bodies first is what I would prefer to have. The other thing is that due to the reform law, the police reform legislation that was passed and is currently out there, there are 16 committees that have been formed and are starting to do all the studies and so forth. One of them is a committee that will be looking at body cameras. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing anything prior to finding out what that committee ends up putting out so that we actually follow, if we ever decide to do it, you know, what we, you know, what they would prescribe us to do. I'd hate to go and spend money on anything like that and then have to unwind something because the committee basically put something out and we're not following it, you know, the way that we should be. I don't know if that answered.
I agree.
Okay.
Quick follow-up, and this is probably applicable to the fire department as well, so I don't know if the chiefs or Jamie want to answer it. With the removal from civil service, and I know, you know, civil service would have a test every 2 years, hopefully, but the list could expire or so forth. How is Franklin maintaining the list? Do you keep a register or a list of qualified candidates so you don't have to? And one of the problems with civil service was waiting for exams to be held. at least in the past. That
oh,
was
it's
problem.
Worse you, than ever.
What's that?
It's worse than ever.
Yeah, but do, you're not in it now. Do you?
We're not in it. So we don't, we pay attention to it, and I snicker every once in a while, and thank God that we got out of it with the fire department at the right time we did, because COVID's been a disaster for civil service. Understandably so in some realms, but I think COVID, in my view, brought out some of the worst characteristics of what the Civil Service Commission is still there. Very poor communication. Karen, for example, I had for almost a half a year to a year asking her to get answers about old lists. And you don't get any responses back. If we were still in civil service, I can assure you from the fire chief's perspective, those young folks that we hired a few weeks ago, and the one who's a local kid we put through the academy, Chris Smith, and just graduated and now he's on the force, we wouldn't have them. And so I think both the chiefs would likely speak to the fact that this is a place to be. I think the industry knows it. I don't want to say we keep a big file of people because that's not really just what we do, but we're a very attractive community based on the investments we make in the equipment, the facilities, our gear, our safety. Many of the points that Chief Lynch just pointed out a minute ago about education and training, people want to be here. We're very fortunate for that. We're very thankful to all of you, the council, everyone in this community for the support. And I don't think I'd be speaking out of turn. I think both of these gentlemen, have their eyes on potential candidates and people that are interested in being here. And much like we just saw with the recent two hires of the police department, having them go through the academy, but not with a guaranteed job necessarily on the other end, when we get there, we try to do the best we can to position ourselves to be able to retain those individuals as well. Chief, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on that question, but that would be my take on it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, because I was just wondering, you would have to have a process. Of yours.
We do
say, well, we're going to get out of civil service and then be kind of willy-nilly.
Well, okay, so we put out, I'll give you an example. We put out a job posting for a paramedics, earlier last year. We obviously got more applications than seats we had. It's just like any other process. If there's good candidates that didn't get a job one day, we can always follow up with those candidates later on if something did become available and the chiefs thought that they were that an individual was an asset down the road. I don't want to try to pretend as if there's some like big, book somewhere with names in it, because you also have to be conscientious. Other people make choices. They move, they take other jobs. We're not out there to be poaching people from other organizations on an aggressive manner. But we don't always put out a job posting for every single job. If we do have candidates that were in a pool already, our human resources office and our chiefs, both know who those folks are. And hopefully we can find enough candidates to fill the slots, like the situation that we're in now, with the additional officer, hopefully we can fill that from people that we already are familiar with, and think would be a great fit for the organization.
But
a good summary, Chief Lynch?
But correct me if I'm,
Mr. Chief, I hate to interrupt, but I think we do do a test every 3 years.
That's what I was
I'm sorry.
Get.
Yeah. No, we do a test.
Right. Yeah.
And some of the folks that are actually already working somewhere else, living in town or somewhere else, end up taking the exam, and we'll, we may end up drawing them again. Like I said, I would love to be able to hire off the test, put them through the academy and all that. But as I just said, I can't wait that year. I don't have enough staff to be able to do that. I can't have that position open that long. So I'll go with the transfer candidate. I mean, it just so happened the timing. I'm trying to help younger people out that also want to be on the job. So the MPTC will allow people to self-sponsor and go to an academy, but they have to have a police department that sponsors them. Costs us nothing. I have to give them a patch to wear on their shirts and a car for the week that they do emergency vehicle operation course, EVOC. That's it. So I had two people that used to work. One used to work as a dispatcher for us before they went to a MEC. I had another kid, highly recommended by most of the folks that are officers of mine that coach, and they went on their own. They pay for everything. They pay the $3,000 tuition to go. They pay for all their uniforms, all their equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And I told them the day that they eventually got into the academy, I have nothing for you. Mm-hmm. I cannot hire you. So immediately start trying to find a job, because after 2 years without a job, you have to re-rotate back through the academy.
Okay.
And they did, and they looked, and they were in positions to start doing it. And then I had an officer say that he was taking a job somewhere else. So I was able to hire one. And then I really wanted the other one and to fill the holes I talked about. So we hired the 50, you know, the second one, the 53rd. And so it worked out for us. I had no intention or expectation I would be able to hire them, but I did want to give them an opportunity. If you've got a degree and you've got the recruit academy training behind you, you should have no problem being picked up in the Commonwealth by some, you're going to get a job somewhere. And it, for us, these two, it was fortunate that something came up and we were able to, you know, pick them up.
Okay.
And I will sponsor anybody that's, a, you know, if they're a Franklin resident, good background and this and that, and you want to do that, go ahead. And I love self-sponsors. There's nothing like an individual that's willing to say, I'm not being paid, I have no job, and I'm going to have to pay $10,000 or about that is what it will cost to get through. That shows a lot of initiative for wanting the job, not just taking an exam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That answers my question. One more question from the vice chair.
Just to clear up something. When this came up at the council meeting, I think one of the councilors mentioned that he thought it was terrible that we made somebody go pay for it and then hire them. That's not the case. If you want someone and they have to go through the academy, we would clearly pay for that.
Absolutely.
Correct. I mean, it isn't like we're saying to somebody, go get trained, then come see us. This, they happen to want to do it, and that's fine. But if you choose someone and they have to go to the academy, we clearly pay for it.
Absolutely, sir. If I'm going to hire someone to fill a full-time slot at our department, then they are going to basically, when we put them through the academy, they're going to be paid by us while they're there. They're not going to have to spend a dime on any of the equipment or the ammo, or they're going to be provided all the equipment they need and so forth. And that's what typically would happen. And if I'm sponsoring a full-time candidate, then they automatically get into the academy when academy opens. These two individuals, 2 years, it took them 2 years as we applied every single time an academy class came available, because those that are coming out and being sponsored by a department to have a full-time job, they're priority. The self-sponsors have to only get a seat that opens up. Due to COVID, a lot of people stopped sending people, and there were openings, and they ended up getting in. I couldn't believe it. The classes went from 50 to 25, and they were able to get in the Boylston Academy. They only had 23 recruits, and they were able to get in. And that's how they finally ended up doing it. And they would have kept, it could have took them 3 years, 4 years. But if we hire somebody to fill a full-time slot off the list, we're going to send them to the academy, then we would pay for everything for them. I did this only because I was trying to help these two so that they could get a job somewhere in law enforcement, one way or the other, because it never comes back on us. They have to sign away everything. We can't be sued. We're not legal liable for anything, and they have to pay for everything on their own. I like young people that want to get on the job, or, mm-hmm. you know, and that's why we did it.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Nothing else? Okay. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next up is Chief McLaughlin.
Yep. So through you, Mr. Chairman, we're now down to page 57, 58, and 59 of 127. Folks look down at the bottom for the total. You'll notice the department budget went up just about $428,000 for this year. The main cost here, the contractual obligations that you hear me say just about every budget, but also this is the first full year of the four additional paramedics that the town hired a couple months ago. I just want to remind the finance committee and all the folks at home, the additional beauty of this is we challenged our fire department about a year and a half ago, Chief, to go find the revenue, and boy did they ever. Now we're on what we hope to be an annual process to make sure our ALS and BLS rates are up to the middle of the pack. The chief and Billy Blanchard and the rest of the staff down there have done a great job auditing our systems and have been able to capture a lot more revenue. So when the public says, oh, wait, maybe the fire department's budget went up, you know, $400,000, that's just not right out of the tax levy, okay? That's also, they're also bringing in the revenue to help compensate for that service. And that's a commitment that I obviously made in the challenge that the fire department had a year or two ago to go do and look at their billing system. And, you know, it's obviously proven to be very successful. I would even maybe venture that they're bringing in a little revenue for other folks as well in the overall pie. So it's a pretty straightforward budget. And as you know, the fire chief's here. We're happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for the Chief McLaughlin?
I always.
Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I just may stop by saying, absolutely, we'll bring Sparky the dog with us if it, in the future, if it helps us. The police don't want to bring that. So. Okay. We'll see.
I'll go to the succession thing. By my count, there's a dozen members of the staff, firefighters, medics, that are 1999 or earlier. One goes back to 86.
Correct.
And of that, half of them are command level people.
Correct.
How many of those do you anticipate?
Well, like they talked about earlier with the police, they do have to give now, recently with the contract, they have to give 180 days notice to give us notice that they're going to retire. Then even up to 90 days before within the actual date that they are expected to leave. So that does give us the leeway to get things in order. Now that we're out of civil service as well, we talked about bringing new people on, but now we also have a plan in place for our promotional system as well. So now we internally do the our promotional system. Our lists going forward that were put in place last July are in place for 2 years. So it'll be us giving these, that's all spelled out, how, what the percentages are, what goes to the written exam, if there's an assessment for certain ranks. So we have that all laid out for promotions in the future. So we have an existing list of all those higher ranks, and we always refresh those lists every 2 years. So that's part of what we do with the civil service in addition to the onboarding. And as far as the onboarding, just to talk about that, we simply couldn't have hired these firefighters this past year if we were in civil service. We just couldn't have done it. The town pays the firefighters very well. They've got great equipment. We're going to have even better equipment very shortly. But I truly think the driver for the people wanting to come here is that we're doing a lot of training. Our training's really, we really put a lot of life into our training program. We're doing a lot of stuff. And we also have now with that reorganization last year in July, we have a reorganization where a firefighter now, if he wants to excel, if he wants to get schooling, the education, et cetera, they want to better themselves. They have a route, a direct route to go right to the top. And I think that's what these young guys want, the training up front and that ability to succeed in the future. And I think that's what the driving force, why we're getting people. Unfortunately, for a lot of fire departments that are around us, they've lowered their standards. We're paramedics to command the Franklin Fire Department. We never, ever, ever want to lower that. The people in the community deserve that paramedic level to come to their house. A lot of departments, unfortunately, whether in civil service or they're not in civil service, have to bring it down to like an EMT level. And we're not going to have that issue here in the foreseeable future. But we do have people that are eligible to retire, and we just don't have the next fiscal year. It's tough to predict, but I think we may have three or four within the next fiscal year that we think have a good chance of retiring. But I wouldn't say much more than that is on the radar screen to retire.
Okay. There was some talk a while back about a SAFER grant that we had applied for.
We did apply for a SAFER grant in 19, which we did not get. The SAFER grant is normally a grant where the federal government picks up the three-year grant. They pick up 75% the first 2 years and 35% the third year. And what the federal government did last year was it's now 100% over the course of 3 years for salary and benefits. Very, very competitive grant. We did not get a 19, but we did reapply for 20. And the results of that grant will probably come out sometime June, July, August of this year. So we give it a shot. We just felt it was the prudent thing to do, to give it a shot.
No doubt. And let's say we get it, I guess for you, is this, would it be applied to this budget or additional staff? Or does it have to be additional staff?
I think it would be new staff.
Okay.
Yeah. At least pending approval of the budget, you know, here and at the council level and moving forward, we hope everybody will support. I think that would be an addition to.
That's correct.
And what we would likely do over the next 3 years, as that process unfolds, probably I'm thinking year two, we'd have to start thinking as a community with those additional bodies, what's the return on investment? And then what might be a strategy that when that grant runs out in 3 years, that cost of the salary and fringe benefits that go with it, how would the, you know, how does that fit into the, in the, in the longer term forecast? As I've said before, the longer term forecast, you know, I'm really hopeful by the time we get to the end of this year, with the news that came out yesterday, that maybe we can start to think about doing some long-term budget planning again, without the erratic kind of uncertainty that we see and we all know we've been in for the last couple of years. So it really would be, I think, a perfect time for the SAFER grant to come through, mm-hmm. not just because of that, it's 100% now. I mean, those are all good things, but it would really do, it really feels like the sun, the moon, and the stars would hopefully be aligned on this, because it would give us a few years to try to think of outside the box about how we can sustain that at the local level, just like we did 2 years ago with the ALS and BLS rates.
One other question. Back-to-back calls, is that, again, as everybody knows, I listen all the time, and it right. seems to be happening a lot.
Yes.
It could have an impact on how many people we need at some point.
Right.
Is that still?
It runs in spurts. Seems, just as you say this, it seems as the last couple of weeks has been an uptick. But we do have them. We have simultaneous runs where all the companies are busy and we have a general recall. We bring the firefighters back. One thing that I would like to do this year is with one of our reserved ambulances, we'd like to fully stock that. So that way, if the two ambulances are out, whether they're at the hospital or they're out at other instances throughout the town, if we get two bandits to come back within a quick amount of time and that third run, EMS run comes in, we'd like to have that truck fully stocked as if it was a frontline piece ready to go. So the town gets, the resident of the town gets a quicker response. And beyond that, that we don't have to rely on a mutual aid company to come in and perform that. So that's something that we would like to do this year, is have a full, even though it's not in service, manned, we'd like to have that reserved ambulance. Now that we have a good ambulance supply, two reserves, one of them just stocked, so two come in and they're ready to go if need be. Or if we had a mass casualty event or a serious event here, we'd have the ability of getting another ALS vehicle at the scene that much quicker.
I had one something else, and I have no idea what it was.
Any questions on this side for the chief? On this side?
No.
I have a few, chief. I did read your budget narrative, as I did with Chief Lynch, too. And I know you've talked about the ISO. That SAFER grant, is it for four additional people? Is that what I read someplace? Or
if we were successful, it would be four additional, correct?
And how much closer does that get you to the ISO? I mean, how close are we to getting to ISO 1?
We don't really know what that number is, but we do know that this town has done in this past year with the training, with the additional four firefighters that we have now, with the upgrade in our equipment, some infrastructure with the water department, we really come a long way, I believe, in the last 12 months to reach that goal. What the manning is for ISO, they don't just come out and tell us you need X amount for X amount of points. They really don't grade it that way. But to show that, especially in the environment, and especially through a COVID year, mm-hmm. that this town had the ability of bringing four people during that time, is extraordinary. And I think that would be a very important factor going forward.
And one other question, talk about paramedics being required and so forth.
Yes.
How many hours they have to be paramedics when they come on?
They do.
Correct. So that's what a couple of, how many hours does somebody need to take to initially get qualified as a paramedic?
Well, since I've never been a paramedic, I'm going to defer to one of my paramedics back here.
About 2,000 hours.
So obviously, if you hired somebody who wasn't a paramedic, they're gone for a year.
And that's the challenge. And then, you know, these fire departments bring on an EMT. They have to provide the expense for them to get that training. They have to cover them while they're at the class for the training. And it is not always a guarantee that person's going to successfully complete the program. So it's really a bit of a gamble. But unfortunately, for some towns, it's simply the only option you have right now. And we're just very fortunate we don't have to deal with that.
And how many hours to recertify as a paramedic?
I'd have to defer.
So 24 plus a refresher.
I'm sorry, 20. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's basically 24 hours of Con Ed plus a refresher every 2 years.
Okay.
So a certain amount. And there's also other things we have to do as far as with the hospital where there are medical control. There's certain classes we have to take through them in order to keep it up and be signed off again.
Okay, great. Thank you.
See, I was just an EMT, so I couldn't even apply here now.
I do have one question.
Susan?
I could. Maybe more of a question for Jamie.
Yeah.
But stick around, Chief. Mm-hmm. The ambulance fees, Jamie, show up in local receipts?
That's correct.
And under which line would it be under?
I think it's, I'm going to, just like the chief, I'm not a finance director, so I'm going to have to punt. I'm sorry?
I see a big number under fees, just in there.
It also shows not.
I think it's under miscellaneous.
Does it?
Chris, is it under miscellaneous?
It's under fees.
It's under fees.
It's under fees. Okay. And then is it directly assignable back to the fire department?
No.
No.
That's an allocation decision by myself, the finance committee, and the council ultimately.
Okay.
All revenue goes, as you know, to the general fund unless specified in a revolving fund. So it does go to general fund.
That's revenue. What I figured. Okay. No, that's all I need. Okay.
One quick follow-up, and then, George, I'll kick it back to you. And you mentioned this in your report. I don't have it up in front of me. How much revenue did we bring in the ambulance fees?
In 2000, FY19, it was 1.3. We project in FY21 will be about 1.6.
And do you happen to know what it was prior to your arrival? Like FY18?
I don't. But I think I might have mentioned it in front of this committee, but in case I didn't, we also do a voluntary report at the fire department. When I say we, Tracy Hosford, who does a great job along with EMS captain, CPE, ambulance expenditures to get extra allowables from the Medicaid. So last fiscal year, we brought in $128,000 from that. And this year, I think we're $122,000 we're going to bring in. And that's real money. There's no fees that anybody takes from that. So that's about an extra $250,000 that we're able to get in the last two fiscal years, along with the ambulance revenue.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That was my question.
Okay. Well, I just asked George's question, so that saves an extra question. Anything else? Last chance? No, thank you, Chief.
Great job.
We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So through you, Mr. Chairman, moving along to Regional Dispatch, Department 225. Gary Primo, the executive director, is on the call tonight. Good news is we just had Gary and we had an update on the MEC. There may not be a lot of questions here, but the appropriation this year that we're recommending at this point is $635,074. As many of you know, and as a part of the regionalization of two regional dispatch centers, technically, both the MEC and the Mendham-Millville, that is now active. There's still some infrastructure work being done, and we hope that Mendon and Millville will be coming online, as you heard a couple months ago, later this summer. But we did apply for what's called the development grant. Again, we have to apply annually. We're very hopeful, if not hopefully very confident in getting that. What I'm doing here is, just to remind the committee, is putting this appropriation in there, which is not a full year's assessment. So this is a half year. So if the grant gets delayed and we don't get it or whatever, at least we have a half year to pay the bills. And if we do get the grant, which we anticipate we will, that $600,000 we would propose to put into the MEC stabilization account so that in FY24 or beyond, if we ever need revenues to cover that cost, when the full assessment comes back online, we do what we do in Franklin. We save our pennies and we make sure there's money in the account to be able to pay those bills. Adding back in a couple of years an estimated $1.6 million for the full assessment, you know, is obviously a huge chunk of money to just kind of ramp, just put back in there. So we're trying to do our due diligence with this. We're hopeful again that the grant will come through. And you know, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions, but Gary's on the call as well if anybody has any thoughts. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Vice Chair.
I know originally there was an assessment based on the volume. Do we know what percentage of the volume going through the MEC is Franklin?
Gary?
I'm sorry, I don't have a video, but I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me, Jamie?
We can hear you loud and clear, Gary.
Hey, awesome. So with Mendon and Millville coming on board, Mr. Vice Chair, the Franklin assessment is 44% of the total budget.
And without them, it was
47%.
Because originally, I thought we were talking 60 or so, which is good.
No.
I don't ever recall a 60 being that high.
No.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, it was always below 50.
Yeah, it was 40. Yeah, it was up to 40.
It was 48, 47, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I think Millville adds like 5 calls a day or something, 3 calls a day. I mean, you know, for the 3,000 people that are there. I mean, and I think that's why, you know, we obviously did this and, you know, we built the building to have this happen, right? So this was part of the objective at one point, was to gobble up some other smaller towns into a larger area. And the state incentivizes that pretty significantly. Everybody pays an extra assessment on their cell phone bill. So there is a dedicated revenue stream at the state level for this type of stuff.
So what's the overall budget total?
Gary?
Fiscal 22 overall budget is $3,766,264. That is further reduced by, as Mr. Helen had stated, the state non department incentivizes us in a couple of different grants. One of them is called the Support and Incentive Grant that immediately reduces our personnel costs. So the assessments that go to the 6 communities is actually just under $2.5 million.
Thank you.
And just to remind me and the committee, there is still some capacity for the regional dispatch, correct? To add another community or two?
Yep, another community.
Okay.
It'd probably be about one. Depends on the size, obviously, but you know, if you're thinking regionally around here, the communities, you know, around this area, you're looking at probably another community possibly.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Gary? I think that's it. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jamie. Yep.
And next up we have Department 240, Inspectional Services. So moving along, I'm on page 65 of 127. A man who needs no introduction, the infamous Gus Brown. As you can see in the budget, it has been bumped up in the proposal about $30,000. The big deal here is, again, mostly that's just COLA, staff costs, and some other minor increases. But the big piece of this is there is actually in here an additional staff member part-time who's actually already on staff. As anybody who's been following the building commissioner's office, there's been a tremendous amount of transition from a staffing perspective. COVID has certainly hit the department, unlike many others. Earlier on in 2020, we had a retirement. Actually, we had a couple retirements down there. We hired Melissa in February of 2020. And then is the infamous story, Tyler, the other permitting clerk down in Gus's office, literally his first day. I know we've probably said this before, but it is pretty funny. His first day was the day of the pandemic when we closed everything. So,
and his birthday too.
And it was his birthday. So the poor kid had his first job of his career at, first job, comes into the office and we immediately send everybody home. In addition, just like a lot of other offices, there have been breaks where folks have been out on personal leave at length. And we've been very, very fortunate with both Melissa and Tyler to have them learn the building office, learn zoning, learn permitting, on the fly, at home, in the office. And we were very blessed this year that a former employee of ours who took some time off to raise her children, Casey Thayer, did come back to help out the building department. And as always, she's been a huge asset. And so we kind of made the decision, given that there's still some staff out on personal leave, we added in a part-time staff person for Casey to help keep our building commissioner sane and alive.
Just a quick question on a large project, Dean Avenue Apartments, the one up by Gorelix, this one over there. Do you guys do it, or is it outside people especially on the big projects?
That's a good question. The state mandates that it's a controlled construction job when it's over 35,000 cubic feet. So it's heavily regulated by the architects and the engineers, but we do go out on every site. Dean Ave was almost an everyday occurrence with me. Same thing with the Westerly. You know, and believe it or not, you learn too. You know, you get to see it firsthand. You see the different building practices. So it's
a combination of local oversight and
100%. Yeah,
the responsibility.
I don't want to give a certificate of occupancy without knowing what I'm giving it for. You know.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the building inspector, commissioner? Guess that's it. Thank you. You're off easy tonight.
Right. Thanks. Thanks, Gus. And finally tonight, the last account on the agenda, 292, animal control. Again, page 68 of 127. The assessment went up a whopping $1,000 this year. As I mentioned last night to both you, the finance committee, and the folks at home. Animal control is a regional agreement. We in Franklin donate the space down on Fisher Street for the staff, and the town of Bellingham runs the entire program. They send us a bill in the mail, just like Gary does at the MEC. And the bill this year is $77,700.
Any questions on animal control?
I got nothing, because as I say to Tracy all the time, the only thing I care about is I just don't want to hear any complaints. And I've said it every year at this meeting. Every year goes by and I've never gotten a complaint about our staff at animal control. They do a phenomenal job.
Okay. And I think that brings us up to a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Discussion on the motion to adjourn. Hearing none, all those in favor of adjournment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, 9-0. Thank you, everybody. And we'll be back here tomorrow night for a DPW, correct?
Yep, DPW.
Thank you.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.